Chapter 2. The dangers of the kingdom of the earth, and the kingdom of this earth itself, the ground upon which his individualities stand, stumble, or die, must enter into his scheme of faithful record. To encompass all this in one harmonious conception is a great feat, and even to attempt it deliberately with serious intention, not from the senseless prompting of an ignorant heart, is an honorable ambition. For it requires some courage to step in calmly where fools may be eager to rush. As a distinguished and successful French novelist once observed of fiction, "C'est un art trop difficile." It is natural that the novelist should doubt his ability to cope with his task. He imagines it more gigantic than it is. And yet literary creation being only one of the legitimate forms of human activity has no value, but on the condition of not excluding the fullest recognition of all the more distinct forms of action. This condition is sometimes forgotten by the man of letters, who often, especially in his youth, is inclined to lay a claim of exclusive superiority for his own amongst all the other tasks of the human mind. The mass of verse and prose may glimmer here and there with the glow of a divine spark, but in the sum of human effort it has no special importance. There is no justificative formula for its existence any more than for any other artistic achievement. With the rest of them, it is destined to be forgotten, without, perhaps, leaving the faintest trace. Where a novelist has an advantage over the workers in other fields of thought is in his privilege of freedom, the freedom of expression, and the freedom of confessing his innermost beliefs, which should console him for the hard slavery of the pen. 3. Liberty of imagination should be the most precious possession of a novelist. To try voluntarily to discover the fettering dogmas of some romantic, realistic, or naturalistic creed in the free work of its own inspiration, is a trick worthy of human perverseness which, after inventing an absurdity, endeavors to find for it a pedigree of distinguished ancestors. It is a weakness of inferior minds, when it is not the cunning device of those who, uncertain of their talent, would seek to add luster to it by the authority of a school. Such, for instance, are the high priests who have proclaimed Stendhal for a prophet of naturalism. But Stendhal himself would have accepted no limitation of his freedom. Stendhal's mind was of the first order. His spirit above must be raging with a peculiarly Stendhalesque scorn and indignation. For the truth is that more than one kind of intellectual cowardice hides behind the literary formulas. And Stendhal was preeminently courageous. He wrote his two great novels, which so few people have read, in a spirit of fearless liberty. It must not be supposed that I claim for the artist in fiction the freedom of moral nihilism. I would require from him many acts of faith, of which the first would be the cherishing of an undying hope. And hope, it will not be contested, implies all the piety of effort and renunciation. It is the God-sent form of trust in the magic force and inspiration belonging to the life of this earth. We are inclined to forget that the way of excellence is in the intellectual, as distinguished from emotional, humility. What one feels so hopelessly barren in declared pessimism is just its arrogance. It seems as if the discovery made by many men at various times, that there is much evil in the world were a source of proud and unholy joy unto some of the modern writers. That frame of mind is not the proper one in which to approach seriously the art of fiction. It gives an author goodness only knows why an elated sense of his own superiority. And there is nothing more dangerous than such an elation to that absolute loyalty towards his feelings and sensations an author should keep hold of in his most exalted moments of creation. To be hopeful in an artistic sense, it is not necessary to think that the world is good. It is enough to believe that there is no impossibility of its being made so. If the flight of imaginative thought may be allowed to rise superior to many moralities current amongst mankind, a novelist who would think himself of a superior essence to other men would miss the first condition of his calling. To have the gift of words is no such great matter. A man furnished with a long-range weapon does not become a hunter or a warrior by the mere possession of a firearm. Many other qualities of character and temperament are necessary to make him either one or the other. Of him from whose armory of phrases one in 100,000 may perhaps hit the far distant and elusive mark of art, I would ask that in his dealings with mankind he should be capable of giving a tender recognition to their obscure virtues. I would not have him impatient with their small failings and scornful of their errors. I would not have him expect too much gratitude from that humanity whose fate, as illustrated in individuals, it is open to him to depict as ridiculous or terrible. I would wish him to look with a large forgiveness at men's ideas and prejudices, which are by no means the outcome of malevolence, but depend on their education, their social status, even their professions. The good artist should expect no recognition of his toil, and no admiration of his genius, because his toil can with difficulty be appraised, and his genius cannot possibly mean anything to the illiterate who, even from the dreadful wisdom of their evoked dead, have, so far, culled nothing but inanities and platitudes. I would wish him to enlarge his sympathies by patient and loving observation, while he grows in mental power. It is in the impartial practice of life, if anywhere, that the promise of perfection for his art can be found, rather than in the absurd formulas trying to prescribe this or that particular method of technique or conception. Let him mature the strength of his imagination amongst the things of this earth, which it is his business to cherish and know, and refrain from calling down his inspiration ready-made from some heaven of perfections of which he knows nothing. And I would not grudge him the proud illusion that will come sometimes to a writer, the illusion that his achievement has almost equaled the greatness of his dream. For what else could give him the serenity and the force to hug to his breast as a thing delightful and human the virtue, the rectitude and sagacity of his own city, declaring with simple eloquence through the mouth of a conscript father, "Have not read this author's books, and if I have read them, I have forgotten ... Henry James in Appreciation 1905. The critical faculty hesitates before the magnitude of Mr. Henry James' work. His books stand on my shelves, in a place whose accessibility proclaims the habit of frequent communion. But not all his books. There is no collected edition to date, such as some of her masters have been provided with. No neat rows of volumes in buckram or half-calf, putting forth a hasty claim to completeness, and conveying to my mind a hint of finality, of a surrender to fate of that field in which all these victories have been won. Nothing of the sort has been done for Mr. Henry James' victories in England. In a world such as ours, so painful with all sorts of wonders, one would not exhaust oneself in barren marveling over mere bindings, had not the fact, or rather the absence of the material fact, prominent in the case of other men whose writing counts, for good or evil, had it not been, I say, expressive of a direct truth spiritual and intellectual. An accident of, I suppose, the publishing business acquiring a symbolic meaning from its negative nature. Because, emphatically, in the body of Mr. Henry James' work there is no suggestion of finality, nowhere a hint of surrender, or even of probability of surrender, to his own victorious achievement in that field, where he is a master. Happily, he will never be able to claim completeness. And, were he to confess to it in a moment of self-ignorance, he would not be believed by the very minds for whom such a confession naturally would be meant. It is impossible to think of Mr. Henry James becoming complete otherwise than by the brutality of our common fate, whose finality is meaningless in the sense of its logic, being of a material order, the logic of a falling stone. I do not know into what brand of ink Mr. Henry James dips his pen. Indeed, I heard that of late he had been dictating, but I know that his mind is steeped in the waters flowing from the fountain of intellectual youth. The thing a privilege, a miracle, what you will, is not quite hidden from the meanest of us who run as we read. To those who have the grace to stay their feet it is manifest. After some 20 years of attentive acquaintance with Mr. Henry James' work, it grows into absolute conviction which, all personal feeling apart, brings a sense of happiness into one's artistic existence. If gratitude, as someone defined it, is a lively sense of favors to come, it becomes very easy to be grateful to the author of The Ambassadors, to name the latest of his works. The favors are sure to come. The spring of that benevolence will never run dry. The stream of inspiration flows brimful in a predetermined direction, unaffected by the periods of drought, untroubled in its clearness by the storms of the land of letters, without languor or violence in its force, never running back upon itself, opening new visions at every turn of its course through that richly inhabited country its fertility has created for our delectation, for our judgment, for our exploring. It is, in fact, a magic spring. With this phrase, the metaphor of the perennial spring, of the inextinguishable youth, of running waters, as applied to Mr. Henry James' inspiration, may be dropped. In its volume and force, the body of his work may be compared rather to a majestic river. All creative art is magic, is evocation of the unseen in forms persuasive, enlightening, familiar and surprising, for the edification of mankind, pinned down by the conditions of its existence to the earnest consideration of the most insignificant tides of reality. Action in its essence, the creative art of a writer of fiction may be compared to rescue work carried out in darkness against cross gusts of wind swaying the action of a great multitude. It is rescue work, the snatching of vanishing phases of turbulence, disguised in fair words, out of the native obscurity into a light, where the struggling forms may be seen, seized upon, endowed with the only possible form of permanence in this world of relative values, the permanence of memory. And the multitude feels it obscurely too, since the demand of the individual to the artist is, in effect, the cry, "Take me out of myself." Meaning really, out of my perishable activity into the light of imperishable consciousness. But everything is relative, and the light of consciousness is only enduring, merely the most enduring of the things of this earth, imperishable only as against the short-lived work of our industrious hands. When the last aqueduct shall have crumbled to pieces, the last airship fallen to the ground, the last blade of grass have died upon a dying earth, man, indomitable by his training in resistance to misery and pain, shall set this undiminished light of his eyes against the feeble glow of the sun. The artistic faculty, of which each of us has a minute grain, may find its voice in some individual of that last group, gifted with a power of expression and courageous enough to interpret the ultimate experience of mankind in terms of his temperament, in terms of art. I do not mean to say that he would attempt to beguile the last moments of humanity by an ingenious tale. It would be too much to expect from humanity. I doubt the heroism of the hearers. As to the heroism of the artist, no doubt is necessary. There would be on his part no heroism. The artist in his calling of interpreter creates the clearest form of demonstration, because he must. He is so much of a voice that, for him, silence is like death, and the postulate was, that there is a group alive, clustered on his threshold, to watch the last flicker of light on a black sky, to hear the last word uttered in the stilled workshop of the earth. It is safe to affirm that, if anybody, it will be the imaginative man who would be moved to speak on the eve of that day without tomorrow, whether in austere exhortation or in a phrase of sardonic comment, who can guess? For my own part, from a short and cursory acquaintance with my kind, I am inclined to think that the last utterance will formulate, strange as it may appear, some hope now to us utterly inconceivable. For mankind is delightful in its pride, its assurance, and its indomitable tenacity. It will sleep on the battlefield among its own dead, in the manner of an army, having won a barren victory. It will not know when it is beaten. And perhaps it is right in that quality. The victories are not, perhaps, so barren as it may appear from a purely strategical, utilitarian point of view. Mr. Henry James seems to hold that belief. Nobody has rendered better, perhaps, the tenacity of temper, or known how to drape the robe of spiritual honor about the drooping form of a victor in a barren strife. And the honor is always well won, for the struggles Mr. Henry James chronicles with such subtle and direct insight are, though only personal contests, desperate in their silence, nonetheless heroic in the modern sense, for the absence of shouted watchwords, clash of arms and sound of trumpets. Those are adventures in which only choice souls are ever involved. And Mr. Henry James records them with a fearless and insistent fidelity to the peripeties of the contest and the feelings of the combatants. The fiercest excitements of a romance de cape et d'epee, the romance of yardarm and boarding pike so dear to youth, whose knowledge of action, as of other things, is imperfect and limited, are matched, for the quickening of our mature years, by the tasks set, by the difficulties presented, to the sense of truth, of necessity before all, of conduct of Mr. Henry James' men and women. His mankind is delightful. It is delightful in its tenacity. It refuses to own itself beaten. It will sleep on the battlefield. These warlike images come by themselves under the pen, since from the duality of man's nature and the competition of individuals, the life history of the earth must in the last instance be a history of a really very relentless warfare. Neither his fellows, nor his gods, nor his passions will leave a man alone. In virtue of these allies and enemies, he holds his precarious dominion, he possesses his fleeting significance. And it is this relation in all its manifestations, great and little, superficial or profound, and this relation alone, that is commented upon, interpreted, demonstrated by the art of the novelist in the only possible way in which the task can be performed. By the independent creation of circumstance and character, achieved against all the difficulties of expression, in an imaginative effort finding its inspiration from the reality of forms and sensations. That a sacrifice must be made, that something has to be given up, is the truth engraved in the innermost recesses of the fair temple built for our edification by the masters of fiction. There is no other secret behind the curtain. All adventure, all love, every success is resumed in the supreme energy of an act of renunciation. It is the uttermost limit of our power. It is the most potent and effective force at our disposal on which rest the labors of a solitary man in his study, the rock on which have been built commonwealths whose might casts a dwarfing shadow upon two oceans. Like a natural force which is obscured as much as illuminated by the multiplicity of phenomena, the power of renunciation is obscured by the mass of weaknesses, vacillations, secondary motives and false steps and compromises which make up the sum of our activity. But no man or woman worthy of the name can pretend to anything more, to anything greater. And Mr. Henry James' men and women are worthy of the name, within the limits his art, so clear, so sure of itself, has drawn round their activities. He would be the last to claim for them titanic proportions. The earth itself has grown smaller in the course of ages. But in every sphere of human perplexities and emotions, there are more greatnesses than one, not counting here the greatness of the artist himself. Wherever he stands, at the beginning, or the end of things, a man has to sacrifice his gods to his passions, or his passions to his gods. That is the problem, great enough, in all truth, if approached in the spirit of sincerity and knowledge. In one of his critical studies, published some 15 years ago, Mr. Henry James claims for the novelist the standing of the historian as the only adequate one, as for himself, and before his audience. I think that the claim cannot be contested, and that the position is unassailable. Fiction is history, human history, or it is nothing. But it is also more than that. It stands on firmer ground, being based on the reality of forms, and the observation of social phenomena, whereas history is based on documents, and the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.